Major Vizard Reel 4. We'd come to the point where Colonel Topper Brown had just told you that you were to go to the DLI, which were infantry. Now, you really looked down on infantry from the sounds of your reaction.
Well, in our youth, we considered ourselves superior because we had this magic weapon, you see, technical and all the rest of it, not rushing about with rifles. But it was a severe culture shock to the four of us, and I can remember we went out that evening and we got very, very drunk. We were living in billets around Millville, and the four of us were in two houses next to each other.
Now, hang on, I thought you were in Northern Ireland. Was it? Had you been sent back to the depot?
Yes, from Northern Ireland.
That was deemed sufficiently serious, was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, there was further the court of inquiry. Brigadier, and he said, we better send you somewhere less sensitive. So he returned me to the depot for posting. I didn't know it at the time.
Right, so that night you got the returned drunk.
Stinking. Because ignorance, you see. After all, I was 22, and we were South Country people, all of us. You talk about Durham, you think about Strikes, Miners, Arthur Scargill, Gala Day of Durham City. It's almost alien to a South Country lad. Just as this part of the country is alien to a lad in concert. We're going south, you know. Anyway, we had to get on with it, so we buckled to, and the four of us, Alfred Strevens, Dickie Cohen, Roy May, and me. And we had our warrants, our movement order, and we got on the train, and we went up to Darlington. And we were posted to a place called Aycliffe. And we were in school, Aycliffe, which had been a school for retarded boys. It's a large school with playing grounds. School Aycliffe. This is now known as Newton Aycliffe. We were posted to the 70th Young Soldier Battalion. These were lads of 16 and 17, too young to fight, who were joined up, young soldiers. They were ill-nourished, ill-disciplined. They lacked any interest in life, unemployed, a really unhappy lot of young men. And the job there was to make something of them, and then when they became 18, they would join the regular forces.
Now, when was this that you'd moved up to Newton? Do you know the date, approximately?
I think it probably was spring, about April. The snow was still, I think it was March, maybe March.
That's fine. Yeah. So the unit you were joining was not a happy one.
No, I wouldn't say that. I'm talking about the intakes. We had intakes. The young men that came in were ill-disciplined, ill-mannered, depressed, had no sort of get-up-and-go about them at all, or very few. And we had some NCOs, and we had one or two warrant officers. They weren't the best material. The colonel was a kindly man. I use the word advisedly. Hubert MacBain. He would be 55, a regular officer all his life. A nice man, but not the man for the job. Oh, I'm not saying he was too old to start with to relate to 17 years.
He'd be a First World War veteran.
Yes, a nice chap. And he wasn't balmy or stupid or anything like that. I mean, he's a nice fellow, but not the man for the job. Kindly, he's a kindly man. Hubert MacBain. Later, he went to Bramsteth, which was the depot of the DOI in those days. And he was colonel, and Tubby Taylor, was second in command. Been with Valrhons in India. Nice enough chap, training major, about 50. And my company commander.
Which was? Which company?
A company.
And he was?
Taylor. The same name as the second command. But he was a younger man, but again, 45, 40. We had one company commander, D. Charles Lackenby, who had been an RSM in the DOI. A good drill sergeant, but he'd made it through the commission.
Did someone like that, who are an RSM, well, in his case, perhaps, did they make good officers? Because the qualities required, were they the same or?
It varied. One of my colleagues, who died, and I went to his funeral last year, he was company sergeant major and went on to become a major with MC and Bar, first last man. It varies in London. Lackenby. Well, he's one of these tall, thin, red-faced, bone-structured face. Excellent on the drill square. Couldn't be faulted. But a bit of a bully. And foul-mouthed. Really foul. I don't mind bad language, but he was the end. Anyway, never mind. He was D Company. A fellow called Buchanan was C Company. He'd been a territorial, I think, at this time. And I forget now who had B Company. But there were 600 of these young men, anything from early 16 to late 17s. Some had been there quite a while, some had just come. And we were organised in companies, and we used to do infantry training. I didn't know a great deal about infantry training, because I'd never been trained in it. And this is why I felt so bitterly about it, because I mean, an infantry octu is 3 months. A machine gun octu is 5 months. We had done 2 months more of that RSM to start with. But looking at it from a more rational point of view, what a waste of money. 5 months intensive training on the Vickers 303 medium machine gun and all its appurtenances and strategies and tactics. Oh, we'd thrown away.
Why were they doing that, though? I mean, I was surprised then.
Short of infantry officers, I suppose.
And not short of.
No. Well, there was a change coming. After all, the Vickers medium machine gun became a standard weapon in support company of infantry battalions. That was already a germ in someone's mind in the MOD, so they were cutting down the machine gun officers. I found my training actually quite useful later, because we used the Vickers. Anyway, to go back to the 70th YS, Young Soldier Battalion, the downright infantry school, equally. The four companies, my company commander, A, was McAdam, who was a chap who had a rubber heel factory in Portugal. in peacetime. He was tall with an enormous circumference. He used to have a gusset let into his battle dress trousers at the back and was consequently known as Victory V by the troops. He was a businessman with a business head, and he organized a lot of events very efficiently. Now, the training we did was pretty basic. There was a lot on the drill square with which I wasn't concerned, because we had sufficient warrant officers for that job. There was a lot of weapon training. I was concerned with that. Hand-to-hand, bayonet training and so forth. There was a lot of unarmed combat, which was becoming popular at the time and useful. And we did a lot of round marching. These were young men, and I described them as being thin, miserable, pimply, depressed, but given 3 or 4 months, which is all it took, of early to bed, early to rise, solid meals, and they were transformed physically. Being grouped together, 7, 8, 9 platoon, 1, 2, 3 platoon, and so on, A company, B company, intercompany football, intercompany competitions, darts, all sorts of things. They began to get a sense of pride. And this manifested itself so that their improved physique was matched by a growing sense of pride. You could see this. I mean, to begin with, when you line them up, fall in 3 ranks, and so on, they said, slam for this. Terrible fight. They were just standing there like this. There was nothing in them. 4 months' time, they were standing like soldiers. They were proud of themselves, upright there. It was visible. And all that had happened was that they'd been taken away from their street corner and their dole queue, shoved into this thing, put through the grinder, a 30-mile march. I've taken them quite a few times, cross country, 30 miles in a day, set out in the morning, have a sack of rations, 50 minutes marching, 10 minutes break, side of the road, pull out smoke, so on, back on the road, off you go. At the end of the day, we approach the guard room. I'd say, right, chin straps down, off the helmet, under the chin, fasten up the jacket, at the trail, because we're light infantry trail. Now, you're tired, but I want you to step up. I want you to do 120, and then the sergeant would go left, right, so I'd get 120, going through the guard, and the guard would pay honours, and turn out and salute and so forth. When you dismiss them, and I was tired, I was only 22, 23, but I was tired after 30 miles, and I used to say to the sergeant, I used to nip in, have a quick beer, and I'd say to the sergeant, let's go down and look at feet. Examine feet. Standard drill. Go down there in the barrack room, all very quiet. Fire picket is the only person around. Say, well, where are the lads? All there's a dance on in the village. They've all gone down. 30 mile round, full equipment, you know, small pack, big pack, rifle, bayonet, all the rest of it, 30 miles, off to a dance in the village. So that was the sort of spirit that was developing. Now,
did everyone fit in, or would some not?
No, there were always some square pegs and so forth. Some who couldn't break the habit of thieving, you know, that kind of thing. When we'd been in Aycliffe for about 6 weeks or 7 weeks, I think, there was a change of colonel. Hubert McBain, we were all sorry to see him go, a nice fellow. He was a father figure. But he was replaced by a totally different kind of man. A man when I last saw him in September of last year. who arrived aged 32, a regular Durham, Jeffries, Peter Jeffries, finished as a brigadier.
What were your first impressions of Jeffries?
Well, a totally different kind of man, a very, very tall man, very lean, very athletic, a man who loved riding horses, a sporting kind of chap, but a shrewd judge of people and a tactician. His mission in life was survival in battle. To come out of a battle alive rather than as a casualty. And he taught us a tremendous amount about survival.
What kind of things then was it?
Well, he sent us out on the 3 days on the moors, after all. And I'd forgotten to tell you this, but after Jeffries had been there about 3 months, 4 months, we moved to Barnard Castle. Barnard Castle at that time was a garrison town, as big as Catterick. Mostly Royal Armoured Corps, but also Royal Tank Regiment. We went into what was called Westwick Camp, which was adjacent to the School of Infantry. And we were to be the demonstration battalion for the School of Infantry's tactical exercises. In other words, instead of doing tutes, tactical exercise without troops, they did tactical exercises with troops, and we were the troops. We were in Westwick Camp, and the battle school, or School of Infantry, was there next door. Well, Jeffries used to send us out when we weren't demonstrating on survival exercises, 3 days at a time, and he would lay out a map, and he would use two companies as enemy, and he'd have one company to get through, and it was the old story, getting through somehow. But we were given a certain amount of food, but not a great deal. We had to forage to quite an extent. I can remember many a chap going to a farmhouse and asking whether they could spare a bit of bread and so on, you know, in order to keep going. And we had to ford the upper reaches of the Tees at night across the river, the rifles up here and so on. He did all that kind of thing. And he taught us how to manage if we hadn't got bivouacs and still keep the rain off us. Ground sheet. What amazing what you can do with the ground sheet. And he also taught us a great deal about slip trenches and sleeping in them. He liked two men were better because you had two ground sheets to line the thing with and two great coats over the top. It's better. I don't think there was ever any illicit relationships developed from that. I never came across any, but it was always better. And this was, he was that sort of man. He was concerned, rather like Alan Hay, with what does the soldier have in his small pack, you know, as what mattered to him, as well as tactics. I don't know about strategy, because I never got into the exalted realms that dealt with strategy. Tactics was my limit, and he was very good.
What sort of principles of tactics was he up to?
We were working on the battle school, and we had to more or less stick to their ideas, but we had areas which had been villages, sadly, which had been vacated by the villagers, and we were allowed to do street clearing there. And we have a lot of experience in this, which is very useful.
What was the procedure they were teaching? Perhaps we'll compare it later with what you actually did. But
well, what they were teaching was very relevant to what we subsequently did. You'd approach these villages, the vacated villages, and there were also some lead mines, old lead mines up on the moors too. And you do house clearing
lobbying grenades, you know, and then Thompson's submachine gun as people came running out and that kind of thing. You did wood clearing, and again, Jeffries was very wise. He said, never go into a wood, he said. Two men in front are looking up, he said. The next two men are looking that side, and back two men are looking up top. He said, people, snipers in top of the trees firing down. He trained us in how to clear copses, that sort of thing. Clear streets, clear houses. Don't rush into a house, lob in your grenades. You don't need to use high explosive. First of all, start the stun grenade, or smoke. Smoke's very good. He taught us all those things. So that, and most of this was battle school practice anyway. And we used to have live artillery and firing over our heads, and live small arms in the hands of PSIs, who would be on the flank as the battalion moved to its attack target, with the battle school students with us. Excuse me. They were in fact the platoon commanders. They were, or supernumerary platoon commanders. I had a lot of students with me, and we used to crawl together through ditches and run and crawl and leap and fly and so on. And the artillery was going overhead. This noise that they make, and then you get the crack across the front of some sergeant who got you nicely 4 or 5 feet away, but you heard it.
Now, they used to allow for casualties at the battle school.
I had two chaps killed. That was mines. Nobody was ever shot while we were there, but there were two fellows who stepped on anti-personnel mines.
How had that happened?
Mistake. Very sad, but it's a mistake. And they were not our fellows, they were students. They were moving forward, and they strayed off their objectives. The routes weren't taped. I suppose they should have been taped, but they weren't. And they were two, but they never affected us, the young soldiers of the family. But by this time, the young soldiers were no longer quite so young, and many of them were becoming 18, and therefore they were ready to leave.
Their training must have been better than many of the normal infantry regiments.
A good deal better.
Battalions.
Intense.
Can I just ask about you? Because a lot of these weapons that you've mentioned, and the main weapons you're using, so you mustn't have been terribly familiar with, for instance, the Thompson machine gun. Had you met that before?
No, we had to go on course for the TSNG, yes.
What did you think of the Thompson? Because we hear varying things about them.
Well, I was never very struck with them. They didn't compare with the German Schmeisser machine pistol, because they hadn't the range.
What was the effective range, then?
Well, I mean...
To you?
The actual 4 or 5 bullet would probably go 400 or 500 yards. It wasn't accurate. It's a short barrel machine weapon.
How far would you say it was accurate up to?
Oh, it's very good for close contact work.
How far, though, roughly?
Oh, 12, 14 yards, 15 yards.
So not even 50?
No, well, if you're lucky. But most of the times you're using a Thompson machine gun, you're moving, you're running, you're panting, and you're not taking a very, you're shooting the hip often.
Was it reliable?
Yes, I never had stoppages. I didn't personally carry one. They were available, but I never used one. Russell Collins used one.
What weapon would you carry then?
I always carried a rifle. Took off mostly the crowns, and carried a rifle.
Did you start doing that when you were in action, or did you start doing that in England?
No, when I was in Africa. But I mean, the snipers around, what's the point of getting yourself killed? I mean, the chaps knew you, everybody knew you, and you said go thither, he went thither.
Was that the sort of attitude that Jeffries had taught you? Cause
survival.
What about the other, the grenades?
Well, I was carried plenty of those.
And where did you learn about the three types you mentioned, mills, smoke and stun?
The high explosive stun and smoke, well, we had training courses. I hadn't come across them in the Middlesex. I mean, things got so bad, you needed grenades, you were all up with you. You were firing on open sights. No, I learned about that when I got to school later. We had
what did you think of the three types of grenades? There were phosphorus ones as well, I think.
I didn't like phosphorus, yes.
What did you think of the three? I mean, the mills, what did you think of
I
that?
I always carried them. I always carried the high explosive.
And was that the mills?
The mills, yes. It's a very reliable. As long as you hold it long enough before you throw it. But I like stun and I like smoke.
What were the stun ones? How did they work? I'm not very familiar.
Well, it's a tremendously, it's plastic. And it's a tremendous explosion. It stuns people. The impact of the air on their ears, you see, and so they become completely confused, and you can rush in then and disarm them. You don't have to kill them necessarily.
And the smoke?
Smoke's very good. Come out choking.
And why didn't you like the phosphorus?
Well, I never found it very reliable, I'm afraid.
You mean it just didn't work?
Well, it didn't seem to work.
What was it meant to do?
Well, the idea is that it has a burning action. And it explodes, and it's like a sprays of caustic burning action.
What about, now, the pistol? Did you use that much, or did you?
Handed it into Guildford Police Station only about 2 years ago, under the amnesty.
Did you ever use it? I mean, would you carry it with you?
Always.
In your holster?
Yes, always.
And what did you think of that as a weapon? I mean, did you actually learn to...
close quarter work, but I preferred rifle and bayonet when it came to it. Bayonet's very useful. Pistol hasn't got any bayonet on. Very handy bayonet. I mean, a chap who's difficult, but if you prick him, he'll give up. Yeah, it's very handy.
So... any other weapons you've been into? I mean, did they have any of the Piat things?
Yes, Piat mortars.
Were you using that at Newton or at Barnard?
At battle school. I first saw them at the battle school.
What did you think of the Piat?
Very effective. But you've got to get there and close enough for range. I prefer limpet mines, really. But there it is. A Piat's quite good.
Did you actually get the chance to fire one?
I fired one.
What were they like to fire?
Quite a kick, but after all, it's like a ball cup with a water system on the front of it, and it's got a spigot at the back. It's launched. It would put a carrier out of action.
What about a tank?
No, I don't think it. They used to say, friends from the 8th Battalion told me that in the desert the German A tank, which was the very first one that they used in 1940, appeared would deal with that, but it wouldn't do anything else otherwise. It wouldn't penetrate the armour.
And limpet mines, they were just sticky mines you stuck on. Well, surely the problem is you had to get even closer there.
Yeah, infantrymen can do that, especially in the dark. And they have a fuse, you see.
And you practice with this sort of thing at the battle school?
At the battle